Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Foundation and Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Foundation on Apple TV+. This week, we're covering Season 1, Episode 9, titled The First Crisis. Respect and enjoy the podcast. Hey, Ron, how are you feeling about Episode 9?
I was a nervous wreck watching this episode because I'm like, there's a couple points where I'm like, oh, this is just fucking up. This is just,
Oh boy.
You know, I don't know what kind of like COVID related difficulties are causing this. But this is, but then I started like, I'm talking in particular, the Imperial escape, you know, I'm like, this just seems like what a, like an escape from a movie like E.T. or Flight of the Navigator would look like, you know, just something that like you just enough detail for kids to enjoy. But then it turns out it was just all put on. I'm like, okay. And just as I was, you know, kind of settling with that, it became like a put on within a put on. And I'm like, okay, I kind of like that. And the other, like the stuff on Terminus, you know, it's like it became clear that something was happening with the vault and it was opening. And I, you know, we just talked about this in the feedback episode, how it's a lot riding on this vault opening. Like if this vault opens and it's some kind of crazy, not even tangibly related concept to what is in the foundation, then I think you're going to have an all out book reader revolt. And they're just going to be like, well, fuck this. This isn't even foundation. Mm-hmm. And it turns out like, you know, I was just like, oh, fuck, what is this, a wormhole? Is this some kind of, you know, gateway to the second foundation? Like, what kind of wild shit is this? Oh, my God. And it turns out, mostly like, you know, just to be kind of like related to the book reveal anyway, closely related, it feels like.
Oh, yeah.
So like this is obviously connecting episode from last week's that bombshell to what sure this to be kind of like a crazy episode, like a mindfuck episode, I think is how Goyer described it next week. But I was a nervous wreck watching it because I was thinking, man, this felt like Ride the Beast at King's Island. This thing's about to go off the rails. It never quite got there, but I was worried. What'd you think?
I do wonder what the quote unquote mindfuck part is going to be of next week, because is it going to be something for the book readers to chew on that surprises them? Or is it going to be kind of, you know, pitched right down their lane, but TV viewers are going to be pulling their hair out, wondering what's happening.
Is it possible that I'm misremembering and he's described this as the mindfuck episode? Because I think you could fairly describe this as a mindfuck episode because as an audience member, I felt mindfucked. if I was Emperor Day, I would certainly feel mindfucked.
Oh, yeah. I actually like this episode quite a bit. I see where there are some shaky parts. I think that maybe the worst part of this episode, and there's a lot to talk about that's good here, so I'll start with the worst. It is the gun hands thing. That was real dumb. Why not just stay in the ship if you're going to use the ship to shoot? You're a lot more protected.
I think it's rule of cool, run amok. Maybe for there is a storytelling purpose for that, but that's going to be useful in the last episode. But it did feel like, yeah, remember the Matrix, you know, those gun robots with the fist guns and stuff. What if that, but remote and ships, you know?
Yeah, I mean, interesting concept, execution, it looked silly to me. But the rest of this episode I thought was really good. I love that mural scene with Brother Dusk tipping his hand here, showing his hand that he knows that Don has some differences, and he knows exactly what those differences are, right? It's not even just, I think you're different. No, I know that color is your thing here, and I'm going to prove it to you. And it's so fucking menacing, like the hands on the shoulders, like appreciate the detail. And then he walks away and then you see the six of the things when he puts the, I'm like, that's fucking cool. That is really cool and scary. I thought that was awesome. And then that's just the beginning, right? Like, because I have some questions around that. I'm like, why would Brother Dusk tip his hand here? Why play your card when you could keep that close to the vest and then surprise him with it later when it's more important. But like the episode very quickly shows exactly why he was doing that, right? He's trying to root out these this resistance movement, whatever it is, whoever's behind the Double Dawn situation. And so it just became even more rich as the episode went on. I was very impressed with that. And then I'm super impressed with Cassian Bilton, who's the guy playing Dawn here.
Yeah.
This episode changed my mind on him because I've been kind of iffy on his performance because he's been playing this kind of... It's like Joffrey, right? It's a character that I think is well played, but I don't like the character. And so when I see him in contrast to a character that's cool and competent and confident, it's night and day. And it's really impressive to see him play two very different characters side by side.
And that's the thing, is it's not that Dawn wasn't sympathetic, but it was nice to hear like a character say, like, calm the fuck down. This isn't about you.
Yeah.
Like, this is about the billions, if not trillions, of people ground underneath your boot, dude.
I mean, 90%
if you weren't colorblind, you would have never had a problem with any of this. You would have just gone along with it because that's what you're programmed to do, essentially.
Sure.
Yeah, that stuff was real good.
Yeah, 90% of the stuff he's had to do is being a little whiny, being a little emo, and that always kind of gets under my skin a bit. And so to see him in a different performance here was great. And I honestly think he's someone to watch. He hasn't been acting very long. He's been in some shorts, and I think this is his first like breakout role. So he was in a short that won some awards at Sundance. So it's not like they weren't good. But yeah, watch him because I think he's going to go places.
How about Terrence Mann?
Oh, like, Jesus, man.
I've always liked The Dusk and Day. Like that's the these have been great performances throughout. But I didn't really notice until he's like in someone's face, red faced and screaming, doing the Lee Pace thing.
Yeah.
Of like how really kind of Alec Guinness, Ewan McGregor that they are doing, probably informing each other, trying to ape each other. I'm sure all that stuff was deliberate, but like it's just really good casting and really capturing the spirit of like, oh, this is the guy that rained down fire on Anacreon and Thespin. And this is the guy, you know, this is the same guy. Essentially, it's not literally the same guy, but the bitched out all of the royal mathematicians and caused one guy to have a heart attack. I thought that stuff was really good too.
Yeah, no, it is. And I was glad to see some kind of, I don't know, movement. This all, I don't know. The Terminus stuff has not felt great to me the entire time, but I feel like we are at a turning point with Terminus, where now it's becoming integral to the story that they're telling in a way that Terminus should have always been, right? And maybe it's just me not caring for the action nature of what they were doing there in what I wanted to be a high concept sci-fi show. But now we're at a point where the vault is open, we know what's inside, and if you're a TV show watcher, you have a shitload of questions, right? Like, there's not just Double Dawn this episode. It's Double Harry. Like, there's a Harry here. There's a Harry there. I don't know what's happening. I think it's going to get way more interesting on Terminus in the next season.
And I do feel like I feel very strongly that regardless of your reservations thus far, that like at the end of episode 10, I think if you're a book reader, you're going to know exactly where you are. In terms of the state of the canon. It feels like that. It feels
they're
like,
you know,
it was a little kind of up in the air last episode, but it does feel like the long arc of continuity is starting to bend back towards the plot.
For sure.
I just, when we were talking about Terrence Mann, I happened to look up because I was like trying to think of like all the stuff I've seen him in. And it happened to be mentioned that he played Rum Tum Tugger in the 1982 Broadway version of Cats. And dear listener, if I had only known that 10 weeks ago, oh, the memes we would have had. Oh, the Inside Cats memes. Not everyone would have enjoyed it. Maybe only three or four of you would have. But, oh, we would have had a good time.
Not every podcast host would have enjoyed it. You would have had a good time.
I'm really, really looking forward to season two.
Nice.
With that, having that information in my back pocket. All right.
Okay. I think it's about time we got into the recap. But first, let's take a quick break. Hear the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV+, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. All right, we start off with young Salvor asking her father where humans came from. He tells her they came from another planet, but he's not sure which one. Apparently, the commentary of that particular bit of history has been lost. She's confused as to why the Anacreons hate them if they're all from the same place. And he explains how emotions work and then uses the scenario to enforce her belief in the Foundation. Do you want to talk about this scene separately from the flash forward here or the now?
Yeah, I guess I do. And especially in terms of Gale's commentary or her voiceover, because most of them I understood what they were going for, but this one where they say history is the greatest weapon. You know, you can make a villain become a hero, a lie become the truth. And she mentioned that this was her history. So she gets to kind of like have a say in that. I wasn't exactly sure what the point of that dialogue was, like what she was trying to. Unreliable narration or what, you know?
I don't know if I can say anything without spoilers on this. I really want to talk about that because I think there's some information there for us to pull out of what she's saying. Because we've speculated, I think early on in the show, that Gale might have a particular role in this story. Anything right now is a little too spoilery.
Do you want to have a book spoiler section at the end of this?
Maybe we should.
Okay, because I kind of want to talk about a couple things too.
Okay.
So yeah, we'll partition that off at the end so sensitive show watchers don't have to have their spoiler senses triggered. The other thing that's it's nice to see Clark Peters back. It's unexpected bonus Peter episode. And it's my, like, I've seen people talking about the differences of show salvor versus book salvor, and it looks like that this is a little bit trying to bridge the gap. Like, Clark Peters is essentially espousing a mature salvor's Hardin's like the violence is the last refuge of the incompetent.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I think the salvor expresses in the novels.
And earlier in the show, I think there's a time when he says it and she rolls her eyes or something like that.
Yeah. That she says, that's an old man's philosophy. He's like, I came up with it when I was younger. I thought that was kind of interesting and a nod to like what salvor will probably eventually become. Like these influences will kind of mellow her and round her in that shape. Although I was also thinking that like violence is the last refuge of the incompetent. I wonder how you understand that in the terms of like a disadvantaged populace or like, you know, let's say you're a peasant, you're a medieval peasant and you want to address the lords for grievances and they're just like, nah. We got all the money. We got all the military.
Then you plot to have one of those three clones stolen and take their nano blood. And
that's true. If you're really competent, you'd come up with some next level plan like that.
Exactly.
You know, sometimes I don't know. Like, was the rebellion and the Star Wars incompetent because they finally blew up the Death Star, or was that? Yeah. I don't know. I guess it depends on how you feel long term about the. And I guess like maybe even powerful empires, say the British Empire, can be undone by like a few 100,000 to 1 million Indians kind of working together, doing hunger strikes and stuff. So like you can, you know, there's other ways to address it beyond violence, perhaps, or suggesting there. But I just thought it was interesting that this is a look into probably what we're going to see salvor become in the season or two ahead.
Yeah, for sure. Boy, I hope she doesn't take on the mantle of her father's corporate mottos is all I can really call them. You know, violence is the last resort of the incompetent. And also past behavior is the predictor of future performance, whatever. That's so like corporate speak. I've heard that in every office job I've ever had.
It's funny. It's the opposite of what you see in almost every prospectus from like a publicly traded company. It's like performance does not guarantee future performance.
Right.
But it is a best indicator. Sure.
Yeah. Indicator. So then we flash forward, which is actually back to now, where we are mid jump on Invictus. Salvor sees the fight that she just had on the bridge play out again in slow motion this time. The jump ends and Salvor finds the ship orbiting Terminus and Lewis Jackton, the navigator station, dead, I presume. Salvor tries to hail Terminus and also the Thespians, but has no luck reaching either. And then I think she spots Hugo's ship out the window.
The Bega. Yeah. Bega. Lewis died hard. He's got Borg shit sprouting all over his face. That neural jacking was not precise.
No, it's precise. The problem is they couldn't find any neurons. They had to go all the way through his head looking for neurons and found nothing.
No brain detected. It just had to keep probing and probing to find that fucking shrunken walnut of his. Yeah. Yeah, I like that a lot. If it put it in Salvor, it'd just been just a little nice neat puncture. But it's got the nice fat brain. I was wondering like what the point of the recent past stuff. Clearly I know there's been a lot of discussion about what Gale's power was like before and after the jump, but I also wonder if we're supposed to like, sure, she had it before, but something was awakened greater in that jump process, because it felt again like, what's changed between the Salvor that failed to intuit her way into the cube and this one? Like, I don't think it's been the experience she's gained or. She opened her fist, but like she also went through the jump gate and her intuition is even heightened now, I think.
Yeah, they do some pretty explicit connecting of Gale and Harry and Salvor in this episode visually. Oh, right. Yeah, when she's trying to open 100%. The Prime Radiant and the open the fist scene. I don't know if they're trying to tell us that they are all like spiritually connected here, or if there is some actual like physical thing in the universe that is binding them together, like the force, right? How many midichlorians do they have? I don't know exactly what that's getting at, but they're definitely drawing them together in this episode.
Or some kind of epigenetic memory that she's been able to tap in. You know, that we've talked about that in relation to, yeah, to cloning and going back to the both Watchmen and Westworld. I also thought that part of the reason they showed that recent past segment is there's a nice shot where you just see the actress playing Farrah just emoting sheer hatred.
Mm.
And I think that that was like part of like that's the crisis. Like, these people all hate each other and they have nothing in common. There's nothing to kind of unify them. And it's going to set her up for the resolution. I think that's what they were getting at. So it's like some kind of greater awakening of this precognition, and also enabled her to intuit a solution to the problem here.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to getting to the end of this, when I guess Salvor takes the last refuge of the incompetent, yeah, and takes out Farrah. I don't know. There's some stuff they're doing there with, like, hey, violence
is an old man's philosophy.
Yeah. Real stupid. And also, I got to use it now.
Yeah, sometimes I do think that, like, that it's the last refuge for sure. But incompetent, I don't know. Like, maybe incompetent people put you in there sometimes too.
I mean, maybe that's the point. But we'll talk about that.
Did you think? Did you have any problem? Because, like, when they first jumped and it went to I was like, huh, interesting. I assumed that Hugo would be rescued by the Thespians and we'd hook up with them probably the next episode.
Mm-hmm.
But then when the ships were drugged through the hyperspace, the quantum wake, I'm like, well, that actually kind of makes sense. This doesn't seem like it's a phenomenon that necessarily hugs the hull of the ship. If you're close enough, you're probably drugged through. So, but then I'm like, well, fuck, Hugo is just going to die out in that asteroid field. There's no fucking way they're going to get to him in time.
Yeah.
Did you buy the quantum wake thing?
Yeah, I did. I didn't have a big problem with it.
Okay. Yeah, I did too.
I guess the only thing I might have a problem with is that you can just jab yourself with some random knockout juice, totally unmonitored, totally, you know, why do you need the spacers if all you got to do is jab yourself with one of these juice sticks?
Here's the thing. I don't know how long.
Take a melatonin and you're good. I don't know that we need spacers.
I don't. So someone put you in a sleeper hold. I don't know what the perceived time of a hyperspace jump is. It seems almost instantaneous from a human perspective, but
mm-hmm.
I don't know that that's true. It might be so. Like, I think you're right to some extent that our boy Hugo here got lucky that he got the duration of the knockout correct, but I don't know. It does seem like it's conscious experience of the warp is what drives you mad, not going through it. So I don't think there's anything. It'd be kind of like a doctor hitting you with a happy juice without an anesthetician there and just kind of quickly operating on you versus having a guy monitoring your heart rates and making sure you're staying under the whole. It's a lot more risky. Fraught with peril,
yeah,
and risky,
mm-hmm,
and a gamble. But also, yeah, I guess I didn't have a huge problem with it.
Yeah, but I mean, dying in a hyperspace jump is the last refuge of the incompetent as well. So I guess try what you can, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dying in shame and failure is everyone's last resort. You know? You can always
resort
to that.
It's the true last resort.
Yeah, exactly. That's our birthright as humans, to die fucking up.
All right. Next scene is Dawn and Azura planning his escape route. Apparently, they're going to go through with this thing. Azura says she can get him a signal damper for his nanobots so that they can't track him. She promises she won't let him down.
Yeah, I like there's a little bit more ominous reading on second watch when he goes, I just don't want to die here. She goes, oh, you won't.
Yeah, right.
And yeah, it's like, this is some cold blooded shit she's saying when you go through a second watch. And here's where it's like, I'm like, I started being like, oh, you know, like, am I supposed to understand that she's just way too optimistic about being able to land her hands on this technology? Like, last episode, she's like, oh, there's machines that can filter nanobots. And
right. This
one's like, I got it. I can get a dampener for your nanobots. I'm like, okay, this sounds like a teenager making stupid promises they don't know nothing about. And when it seemed like it was going according to plan, I started being like, I just don't buy that this is bushwhacking the Empire, man. I just don't. And thankfully
it didn't.
Turns out that was that. But I was getting real worried at parts of this episode.
Yeah. Do you think the face swapping is real, or do you think that's just total bullshit? Just complete fabrication.
Oh, I have no doubt that they can swap faces like this. Yeah. Their medical technology seems just incredible. Yeah. Those nanobots, like I'm surprised they don't have like, you know, I think there's they're called like face dancers in Dune. Like people can shift their face in real time. Like I'm surprised you can't just like, you know, you got perfect cloaking technology and you got these nanobots and I have zero problem with them doing all kinds of weird shit like that, which again. That's something you got to be careful with that kind of technology, because you can just infinitely buffalo and baffle your audience until they just don't give a shit. Like Westworld's always walking that fine line between fuck who's marbles and what body and why do I care? And who's, you know, it's like,
and so everyone's a robot. Why do I care? Yeah.
Same thing with Rick and Morty. When you have that kind of crazy technology that can solve and do anything, it's very hard to, you know, keep the audience engaged. So, that's that fantastic technology indistinguishable from magic is a hell of a drug. I'm curious to see how the show deals with the recreational use of it going forward.
Yeah. All right. We now get to my favorite scene of the episode, where Dusk shows Dawn the newest addition to the mural commemorating their hunt. Of course, Dawn can't see the colors of the mural, but he claims he can see the three Gilliraptors he shot. So Dusk asked him to stay here and appreciate the subtleties of the latest edition. And then he leaves and Dawn puts on his color correction devices and sees, oh boy, I fucked up. There are actually six Gilliraptors on this wall. And so he rushes to his quarters. He packs a bag, but then the Shadowmaster summons him to the Principium Tower. But Dawn ends up knocking him out with his aura, runs through the servant's exit into the underground irrigation system, just as they planned before. And he falls into a pool of water that's being cycled.
So I begin the scene like fully engaged and engrossed, because this Dusk Dawn thing was pretty badass.
Yeah.
And I knew he was fucking with them from the painting, you know, but I'm like, when he puts on his corrective glasses, is he going to see like a Zurus hung from one of the orchard trees, or like what kind of crazy shit is he going to see? And just the six Gilly Raptors, especially with Bear McCree, he like really
that music
got after the ominous horns.
Yes.
And it felt like the perfect, like Dawn's like shitting his pants. And like you said, the way Terrence Mann did this with his hands on his shoulders and like, respect and enjoy my painting, son. Like it was just really, really menacing, and it's great. And then, you know, the Shadow Master, we've known this guy's bad news since he showed up. You don't show up as a Shadow Master and not be up to no good. But there's a lot of these little details I like. Did you notice, like, when he's walking down the Princeps Hall, that like all the Kleons are like turn, and that's the way they work, right? But now they feel judgy,
right?
Like, and condemnatory, and that was a really cool touch.
It was super cool. I love the stuff that they're doing with the commentary about history here too, right? Like the use of art to create commentary, because if he is creating commentary right there, he's using the colors that Dawn can't see to then create a commentary once he can see them. It's actually really well designed, this whole scene. I'm kind of blown away by how good it is. And Terrence Mann's a big part of that.
It works so well with episode three, like Brother Dusk shuffling off to darkness, feeling kind of the weight of the judgment of history on him as well, walking the same hallway. And then young brother Dawn, who there's been something off this whole time. Now the Kleons are all judging him in the exact same way, finding him wanting. It's really nice. Now I went back to being nervous, because again, like this guy is walking through the royal palace and like the guards is kind of like, you know, he's just, I don't know, getting by with nervous looks and fast walks and stuff. And then he fugitives himself off of this water recycler, and I'm like, what the fuck? How's this guy like this? This seems insane. Like if they can track his nanoparticles, then what the hell? He's not moving that fast and he's still on Trantor. I just kept on excited. There's just no way this is working. There's just no, this is like, I'm like Princess Leia on the Millennium Falcon. This is way too fucking easy, guys, which I guess, again, this all makes sense in the context. But I was really, really kind of like, I don't know, guys, this is not great. It's not a good escape.
No, I feel you. But yes, they do take care of all that by the end of the episode. And actually, like a lot of it, a lot of stuff they do after this in the episode lends a new context to these scenes and makes them even better in retrospect, because I think, you know, coming out of this scene, I had the question, like, why does Dusk show his hand here? This is kind of a mistake on his part. And by the end of it, I understand perfectly why he does. It's to push him out of the palace, get those resistance, get him in the hands of the resistance so he can track him there. It all makes perfect sense. Yeah. I really like it.
They don't care about Dawn. He's already expendable. They want to get to the bottom of this plot.
I do wonder what the Golden Horse Rebellion is all about. I wonder if there is more of that in the books, if that's something like a nod to book fans.
It doesn't ring a bell. And the other thing is that I was unsure about is Empire here implying that the genetic dynasty brought an end to the robot wars? Because my impression was that this was something that happened many, many thousands of years ago. Like no one really remembers what it's like to be robots, but the way he stated, now it could be in the exact same way that like someone in a Western style democracy might allude to things happening in ancient Athens, Greece as part of the tradition, you know, like this is some kind of democracy that stretches back thousands of years, like some kind of, and the way that the empire is 11,000 years old and we are the ultimate perfection of that empire, but we still draw a lineage back. You know, this galactic empire still is a one unbroken line that goes back to blah, blah, blah. It's just, So I don't know, but that's something I want to ask Goyer if we can get him back for a wrap up is like, can you clean up some of that? Because I think it matters. Like, you know, if robots are something that was recently wiped out, that changes how I think about Demerzel and how she fits in with the Kleon dynasty versus if she has been kind of evading and in the background for multiple thousands of years as the only robot left, that changes how I think about her as well.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, let's move on to a really quick scene here. Salvor suits up and jumps out to Hugo's ship and wakes it up.
Do you think that they continue to like this, the space jump, you know, like it's dramatic and she almost misses it. I almost wonder if they're going to make a point because clearly they're telling young and experienced Salvor. And I think that is going to then transition to a more mature, practiced, capable Salvor later. Are they going to use like her ability to nail these jumps as like a sign of that personal growth? Cause I'm not sure why they keep going back to the fraught spacewalk well in this episode.
I mean, this is the quote unquote exciting part of the show, right? The more action oriented part of the show.
And I don't know, maybe that's really great in the 16 to 24 demographic or whatever. Just like as the 44 year old, old science fiction geek, I don't know that I need every episode to be jam packed with excitement. Especially stuff like this, that's, you know, like there's no fucking way Salvor's just going to skip off and go into deep space. And if she is, then it's only so Hugo can swoop and save her. And that wouldn't look good in today's political climate. So let's just have, I don't know. Maybe in season two, we can do less of that. Maybe
need to make better.
Maybe
use
people
the
are crazy about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, you come in feet first and you're pretty much good.
They mentioned that in the official pod that there was like kind of in their minds, not sure if the ship had artificial gravity or was big enough to sustain some form of gravity versus not sure if there's a mag boots thing. And so they kind of like it's a little muddled.
Gotcha.
So but because you're right, mag boots seem like they would just maybe break your ankles, though.
Sure.
Get a good stick and then you scale that momentum. Also just fire. Did she run out of go juice in her chute because it was a long jump?
Maybe. And it's like she's jumped twice now in the same suit. So maybe, yeah.
Maybe. Yeah, she doesn't have, because they mentioned, I think she, I don't have subtitles for these screeners, but I think she said four moons. That's some kind of, like, that's some kind of oath they swear on Terminus. Four moons, that's a jump, you know?
All right. Yeah, I missed that without subs. All right, Dawn's flushed into an area of the irrigation or hyperloop system where a bunch of humans are squatting. He gives one of them his aura in exchange for his jacket and asks for directions to the district that Azura lives in.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's much to talk about here.
This is shades of Bruce Wayne trading his coat to the Russian guy in Batman Begins.
Yeah.
Seeing the unwashed masses, the underclasses of Trantor under here. And he's just I thought it would be more dramatic if there was flashes that people recognized the Empire.
That's
and
the thing.
People are like starting to whisper and point to him, and he feels like he's got to keep moving. He's got to disguise. And I didn't feel like they established that.
Seems to even hint at the recognition there, which is surprising. Yeah. Like, I'll give it to him. And actually, if you listen to the official podcast, they said that even the guy on the Maiden recognized Empire. Because we were wondering about that. Did he recognize him or not? It would be kind of impossible for us to believe that he wouldn't recognize him. They said he did. So yeah, everyone here is going to recognize the leader of the planet that they live on, right?
When I would think so.
Ensconced in a massive statue the size of,
especially when he's dressed up in his pale blue day or dawn pajamas, you know, like he is in an immediately recognizable context and setting and costume. And again, it would have done nothing but make the scene more exciting, unless you want me to believe that this is like literally all staged. Like everything is mapped out.
All these people, there's so many people.
That's what I'm saying. It just doesn't. And it would have played better, and it would have felt like because I felt like as soon as he got out of that muck tunnel, he's just made in the shade. There was no tension. It was just done. And I think if he got the coat on and he's kind of like, you know, over, like he could start to kind of relax and put himself into her world, which I think worked in the next scene. But I could use a little bit more like, I'm still being hunted. I need to stay on my toes. And it just felt like once he got off the palace grounds, I know he wasn't, but it felt like from an audience perspective, he was kind of on easy street.
Yeah. Yeah. And also they do a little bit of showing that the coat, he's like huddled in it and he's cold.
Yeah, he's shivering.
Yeah. It almost made it feel like he got the coat because he was cold, not because he wanted a disguise. Right.
Rather than he needed. Yeah. Which made him, you know, one of the few things he did, I think getting the coat to disguise is like, you know, one of the few things he did that felt savvy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I just can't help but think, man, how much more is that aura worth than some ratty coat?
Dude, and what is that guy going to do with it?
Yeah, right? He's going to be the ruler of whatever district, the Hyperloop district.
Yeah, you do wonder what kind of... That's the thing. It's like it would have been also really interesting if they did establish that this was all set up as part of the network. Like, you know, that old cooter showed up at his apartment and like handed the new day or the new dawn his aura, because they need the aura, right? You know, they can't touch this guy without it and they can't harvest it. So like it'd been, but they didn't. So I don't know. All these underclass people just don't give a fuck.
All right, then we go back to Salvor trying to use Hugo's ship to contact Terminus. No active comms are detected. Hugo comes flying up to the ship, though, and she brings him in and says, he says, I survived by knocking myself out. And she gives him an update, says the vault's null field is expanding and she has to go back to stop it. There's a lot of emojis in this scene. And then the plan involves the Thespians knocking out the Invictus jump drives so Terminus can have the ship, and Hugo agrees to help, and then he goes to chat with him.
Yeah. They did use the scene to establish the fist guns, the detachable gun controls, because she was going to, instead of just, I don't know, moving the ship a little bit out of the way, she was going to blow Hugo away. But there's some nice stuff, like, you know, for going back to their first scene this together, him saying that the one thing I know is I have this unbreakable trust in Salvor Hardin, and she uses that against him like you do sometimes in relationships. Like, hey, you know, where's this unshakable trust? And Because he's scared, you know. He makes the pitch to every lover does when shit's real and the obligations of your sweetheart really seems inimical to their continued safety and happiness. You're like, shit, fuck, we can just go, man.
Yeah,
we can just hit the bricks. There's nothing that says we got to stay. And she's like, no, I got to see it through. I liked it.
It was a pretty powerful scene. I thought both of these actors did a great job. Hugo doesn't doesn't have to do much here. He's pretty stoic, but you can see like there's something going on underneath that, you know, he's not going to break, but his eyes are welling up.
Plus it does require faith, because the last time they trusted in her intuition, her dad died and they all got taken prisoner. So it's not like that this has been, you know, just an unbroken string of successful coin tosses. There's been a misstep or two. So I thought that, you know, that it's really being tested there. I will say, I think they ought to look in, that Hugo ought to look into something called like a docking bay.
Yeah.
For his ship, because doing spacewalks to and fro. I mean, bro, it's a rough way. It's a rough way to get from ship to ship, man.
Yeah, I imagine there's not a lot of mid space docking in this universe.
Yeah, like, it might be like, hey, smart guy, why don't you have a docking port on your car?
You know?
Like, oh, you just use it for high speed travel and don't like, okay, fair point. But still,
I've seen enough movies to know that cars can end up in space. So maybe that'd be a good idea.
That's true. In real life, even, turns out.
True. All right. Is there a speech about what the scar means to the underclasses? Happens as Dawn walks through the city, picturing Azura in those places that she told him about. And he eventually makes it to her apartment. They make out and she burns his stinking jacket. He worries about the Empire tracking him here. And she invites him to wash off the stink in her shower. And while he's in the bathroom, she fetches a gun and starts taking shots at him. Now, this is confusing. If you need his blood, you probably don't want it spilled all over the floor. I don't know. Was she shooting him with like some pulse stun rifle thing?
Yeah, it could be some, right? You know, like they always talk in the Expanse, like they have those gelatin rounds. It does look like they're blowing holes in concrete.
Yeah. So I don't know.
The other thing is like he's got that nanotech. So even if you shoot him in the stomach, like I don't think he can die. Like he's got multiple levels of not dying built into him.
Okay.
Maybe if you shot him in the head, but I presume she's not doing that.
Yeah, that's fair. He runs. He's captured by another version of himself and some goons. And this is where it's really hard to believe that no one would recognize him, right? There are two versions of him running around out there, both in pajamas.
Yeah, it's causing a ruckus. But they might, I don't know, they might, the cell might own that little square that's outside her apartment. Who
the
knows?
Little bubble garden, whatever it is.
I did think, like, so when I thought of the scar, I thought it was going to be something like Zion from the Matrix, you know, where it's like very crowded and everybody's stepped on top, but you have that little tiny sliver of like freedom and it's like they're disadvantaged and they might not have the best clothes and they might not have the best houses and stuff, but you know, they're free. They have a mm-hmm. form of freedom that they've never known before. Like there's this like little sliver that's outside the Empire's direct control. The way it was envisioned on screen felt like the scar had been hella gentrified. Like,
yeah, I was going to ask you what you thought about the aesthetic of it. Yeah,
it felt very like the nice parts of downtown LA around the Staples Center. It felt very like, yeah, like people had moved in and made like the upper classes, people that are like the gardeners for the Imperial Garden. They really like the authenticity that living in the scar provides. So they've paid through the nose to get on the very edge of the scar and made it all bougie.
That's kind of what I assumed. Like she has a really good job, right? Like
she has to. Yeah, she is not an underclass. There's no fucking way. There's no fucking way the Empire is going to have untouchables.
Yeah.
You know, doing his gardening.
So that was me. Like, I kind of understood, okay, this is not like the true underclass. The true underclass has far less. They're living in that fucking hyperloop.
They got pushed
out
5 years ago or something. Exactly. They're down. And it's kind of like, so this could be in my mind. I'm like, okay, it could be that they're trying to go for the Zion thing and they just, again, didn't have the extras for it. So they had to go for something a little bit, you know, or It could be commentary on how out of touch Azura is. She thinks that she's a freedom fighter fighting for the poor huddled masses. She doesn't even know where the poor huddled masses live.
Right.
Like, yeah. Go down into the shit tubes, lady. That's the real. So, and there might be some commentary of like, you know, it wasn't it the case that like all of the Saudi nationals that attacked 9/11, they were all from fairly wealthy, well-educated backgrounds. It wasn't like they were the people ground under the imperial boot of America. I wonder if there's some deliberate commentary about, like where we think revolutions and revolutionary forces come from and where they actually tend to come from in wealthy societies.
Could be.
I don't know.
I am more interested now in this part of it, right? I didn't realize it, like, obviously there was a resistance. The Star Bridge doesn't get blown up without a resistance movement, but it seems like it goes deeper than that, than just like this one act. That was kind of just the beginning. And I am super curious to see where this goes. Cause when we get to that scene, the nanobots scene where they're taking them out and the whole game changes here, I want to talk about that because it's fascinating to me where this could go.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
All right, next up, Hugo leads the Thespians to the Invictus jump drives and the bridge where Farrah has escaped her bindings. And then Salvor lands on the planet to find everyone in town incapacitated. She approaches the vault and finds her mom laying feet from it with the Prime Radiant in her hand. Salvor takes it and channels Harry and Gale in order to open the vault. The null field's disabled and her mother wakes up, and then a door appears at the vault.
I like to think that her mom had, through careful scientific principles and study of psychohistory and mathematics, figured out that the Prime Radiant was connected to the null field and what had a last, like, was trying to solve the problem. I don't know how the hell she escaped from the Anacreons and got here. I would love to know that.
Well, but last episode, didn't she tell the Anacreons, hey, we need to fix this because it's going to take us all out? So maybe they let her?
Seemed to be very skeptical. She seemed to be all alone out there.
Yeah.
So I think there's enough there that I'm not like, eh, this is bullshit. Yeah, but like, yeah. I what I'm saying is, like, I like that her mom got to where Salvor was at with probably studious, you know, work instead of intuition.
Sure.
That, like, some, you know, like, she is sure the chosen one, but like, it's almost suggesting that, like, had coins bounced a few different ways, that the Terminus people didn't need saving by the chosen one. They could have done it themselves. And also open question about whether Salvor could have solved the puzzle if it hadn't been for her mom, you know, kind of figuring out and like passing out in the middle of solving it. Right. Like, if her mom wasn't lying there with the Prime Radiant in her hand, stretching to the vault, would Salvor have been able to figure this out in time?
Right. She spends the next 3 weeks trying to figure out what's going on while everybody lays unconscious in Terminus.
Right. And the Thespians come and land because they don't believe in this null field shit. And they crash land. And yeah, it's just this whole fucking deal.
I really love that overhead shot with everybody knocked out on the ground. That's pretty cool. And then, you know, the moment we talked about earlier with the open your fist moment, right? This is the thing that her dad has been telling her. She needs to just kind of relax and let the universe speak to her. And it does here in the form of a vision. Is she seeing this, or are we seeing this as an audience understanding what's going on in her mind?
I think that this is a heightened, more concentrated version of the visions that she's always gotten, you know, like this is, but like, it seems kind of like she's tapping into like her genetic memories of her mother or something, or she is able to tap into her mind or memories somehow because of their connection. I'm just going to assume the father-daughter's mother relationship between Gale and Raish and her.
Right.
It's not clear. I think that there's still some mysteries about exactly what we're seeing here. But it does seem like, you know, she had the memory of her mother being able to figure this out on her own and opening it. And I got it right on my second try. And then you see. So I felt like I grokked with it. Yeah.
Okay. There's a lot of also narration here from Gale talking about history, right? And how the only invention that humans have come up with that can alter the present through the past is history. I think that's interesting. Is that of a piece with, you know, Harry coming out of the vault? I mean, he is literally history at this point, right? He's dead.
And the guy who lies. And
interprets
the guy who
history.
Sure.
To predict the future. I mean, and he's definitely changing the present at this point.
What was your reaction to the vault opening? Because I was flipping the fuck out. And that thing started opening and digging into the earth and like transforming. I was like, literally like, what?
Yeah, I had no idea
what was going on.
I guess I hadn't envisioned what the vault opening would look like ever. I assumed it would just be some sort of dissipation or something and it would just sort of be gone. But yeah, when it cracks open like a walnut, and then you've got like a heavenly gate there. I didn't know what was.
Because I was still.
I thought she was going to go through it and maybe end up on Helicon or something. Like it was.
Dude, I thought it was going to be this like essentially Termini fire drill. that like Salvor's going to walk through and find out in Helicon and somehow is going to reroute Gale to Termin. Or, but I was like holding out hopes, like, Jesus Christ, can Harry Seldon just please step out of this thing?
Right.
Can he fucking, like, or, you know, it's like even like Salvor going in and like experiencing some kind of Heaven's Gate where she communes with Harry. Like, sure. That, I'm like, just can fucking Harry step out of this thing? And thank God he did, because I was really like, I just don't know. I don't know how you're going to. Because I secretly hope that the rift between the book lovers and the show watchers can be healed, you know, that the book people can relax a little bit. And like, they're not, you know, like, this is still going to be 80-90% foundation and those core thoughts, but they're also playing a little bit of jazz with it. That's what I'd like for the show.
Yeah, me too.
And like, if it was going to be some kind of Stargate shit, I was like, wow, I don't know. So
it definitely would have changed my perception of where the show was willing to go. And what show I'm watching, you know, this would have been foundation in name, and maybe in spirit, but certainly not in plot. This is much more in line with the plot of the book Foundation.
Yeah, 100%. That's the thing. Because we talked about this in the feedback episode. I was prepared, like, if the show decided to just ditch some of the central concepts of the Seldon crises and do something completely different. I'm like, that's not invalid. And I'm, and you don't have to throw out all of Psycho history. The rules of robotics to do that kind of stuff too. Mm-hmm. That said, I was really glad to see Jerry Harry step out of that thing. So
yeah, if for no other reason than we still get Jared Harris on the show.
Because when her mom's like, is that a door? I'm like, what the fuck? What is happening?
It is. It's just a one-way door. Okay, Don wakes to find his nanobots being transferred into a copy of himself. We've got a double Don situation. I'm going to call the Don from the palace. Well, yeah, the Don from the palace, Don 1. And Don 2 is the Don who's trying to steal his nanobots. Okay, with that said, let's recap the rest of this scene. Don 2 tells Don 1 that he's planning to take his place in the palace, and he's able to do that because he's genetically identical to Cleon the First, unlike Don 1, who was genetically altered by whatever group Don 2 is working with. They're about to kill Don 1 when Dusk and the Shadow Master come flying in, killing Don 2 and taking Azura captive. The surviving Don tries to plead. Now we're back to just one Don, so we're good here. I can just say Don now. Tries to plead his case as victim, but Dusk sees his flaws as an embodiment of the fragility of their dynasty. And then he tells Don he can plead his case today when he returns. And we get an ominous shot of Day of Lee Pace just staring at Terminus. Or sorry, dude. Not Terminus, Trantor as he's returning. Oh,
I want so bad to see what Day makes of this Dawn situation,
right?
Because I think it's going to be pretty fucking glorious.
This is a just wait until your dad gets home situation. That's literally what Dust told him.
And then you see Dad pull into station wagon, and he's fucking lit underneath like he's telling a scary story.
He just got a demotion at work.
This is very not a good, this is not a day. This is a very stormy, cloud covered, overcast day. This is not a bright, sunny, optimistic day. So I'm like, I was so moved by anticipation for what this is going to look like when he tears literal strips of ass from Dawn next episode that I looked at the time left, because I was like, oh man, if there's 20 minutes left, I might get to see it. And it was like 10. I'm like, fuck, I'm gonna have to wait till next week. But
that's the thing. I just want to watch the next episode. After all of this shit happens, I just want to see the next episode. Harry Seldon steps out of the vault. Give me the next episode.
It's such a multifaceted, and probably for the first time this whole season, the dual cliffhangers at both Terminus and Empire really, really worked, where it's like, man, I just want to see it.
Yeah.
And the way they got here is like, they were maximum like cruel to Dawn. Like, Azura is like sitting on New Dawn's lap, and you know, they're both taunting about him, like what a baby he is and how he is.
I mean,
everything they're saying is true.
Yeah.
But it's also not Dawn's fault. And it's also a just, you know, huge personal betrayal that he probably has never felt before. You know, like, he's getting his heart broken. And not only that, but like, she's going to kill you, dude. She's going to steal other things to make you special, supplant you, tear down your family from the inside, and cast you aside like a husk when she's done.
So I really think this scene is good in a lot of ways. It does a lot to recast scenes we've seen before, like that mural scene. That takes on a whole new, richer meaning after seeing this, because we know that this was all part of the plan. It also kind of it makes the Gossamer Court scenes in previous episode so much richer too, because it's not just that was a one-time thing where he sort of takes him aside and, you know, this is a thing that all happens to all Dons. It might be, but it shows you the control mechanisms in place inside the palace, right? It's more than just, we've got some concubines who we're going to try and get you to talk to before we erase their memories. They've got these dragonfly things, which are seemingly given to the Dons to use, and yet they're being monitored. There's just
like everything.
Yeah, the nanobots are being tracked, right? All of this creates a very oppressive feeling in the palace in retrospect. And I think this scene really helps that.
And it nails down it's such a great dichotomy that the Empire is literally in charge of everything but his own fucking life.
Yeah.
He has no privacy in a very literal sense. He's ultimately replaceable. He does not matter. He's singly the most important personage in the universe and the one with the least amount of individuality. I love that that tension in that character.
Yeah. The other thing it does is it set up exciting new possibilities, because my head is just swimming with okay, who is this resistance movement? I mean, I know their goal now. Their goal is obviously to take down the Empire from within. It's not just Starbridge stuff. Although I do link this to the Starbridge
same
attack. And so I'm starting to think, okay, who could want the Empire taken down? And immediately what pops into my head is Harry Seldon, the psycho historians. And he has a following that's growing. They make a point of that, right? How people are starting to hear of him and believe in him now that he's martyred. I mean, that this could be a multi-stage plan by Harry Seldon to take down the Empire from within, because he might see that as, you know, an inevitable thing that needs to happen to speed up the collapse of the Empire, thereby speeding up the Dark Ages, right? The revival from the Dark Ages. That could all be of a piece. I'm not certain that's happening, and I don't know that there's enough to say one way or another if that's true, but that's where my head goes.
There's two problems of this scene that I had. One, I think in retrospect is not a problem. One that might be, but it's kind of who cares, is that these people are so well equipped and patient and long thinking in their plans. And I felt like there was a lot of question mark around how are you going to get Dawn back into the palace? Like, this guy's gone rogue, and are you going to explain it like, oh, well, I just was stupid, or did I wish I knew a little bit more of how they plan to reinsert that, but that doesn't matter because ultimately they get shut down by the Empire.
Yeah.
The second, I remember thinking that if I find out that Azura is part of some kind of plan, that I'll be disappointed, because how the fuck do you put a person that just happens to be outside the window this guy's going to take a header off of? And I think I'm fine with that now, because they clearly set forth a scenario where they have subtly manipulated Dawn since he was born to,
right?
You know, he's been just pushed and molded into this trajectory. And maybe it's not just Azura that's in the palace. Maybe they've got other, you know, spies as well. I think that's interesting. And since we didn't know, not even Demerzel with all of her, you know, skills and abilities and the power of the Empire could find out who actually was the button man for the Star Bridge. Mm-hmm. I assume this stuff is connected, but I wonder if we're going to start to get a little bit more connections, so the Empire is going to realize how deeply compromised they are. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, that's pretty compromised. I'm coming up with questions about the cloning process and mostly the monitoring process of these clones. Like, how do you hatch a Dawn that isn't perfect?
Well, they were. They mentioned that there was some I wrote down the name, magnetic nanoparticle transfection. So apparently he was a pure clone that was manipulated over time, like in the first few years of his birth, to become colorblind and to, you know, they remapped his genetic code of these nanobots. But that's still just, that just punts the question one layer down. Like, is there, but on the other hand, like, I don't know, yeah. Do they fucking constantly check the Dimper's DNA like every day? Like, oh yeah, you're still Kleon. You know, like, why?
Probably not.
Yeah, once you get like the Imperial doctors like look at the baby and be like, yep, this is a one right, like they probably don't do that all the time.
I would suggest they put those protocols in place now. Now yeah. They know that this can be done.
Go full Gattaca, man. Every time you take a piss, every time you shed a skin, yeah, like just constantly do the Gattaca protocols. It seems like it might be. And I guess that's kind of exciting, seeing the fact that this empire is going to be the eternal foe, seeing how they try to stave off some of these disasters, because clearly, yeah, you know, what Day's done on the Maiden is just going to probably make the situation worse in ways we can't predict. Like everything they're trying to do, yeah, it's, you know, the tighter you tighten your grip, the more planets slip through your fingers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The Princess Leia theory of governance.
Yeah, I think isn't that the quote that Gale goes with at the end of this? No.
Yeah.
All right. The Anacreons attempt to keep Salvor from going into the door in the vault. Thespians land and force the Anacreons to surrender. Then Farrah flies in, shoots down the Thespian ships, then
plays her Uno reverse card.
Right. Forces the Thespians to surrender. I think this is the weakest part of the episode by a long shot. Until Harry steps out. But Salvor suggests that Terminus, Anacreon, and Thespis all band together to leverage the Invictus in a better way than just destroying it. And the vault opens, and Farrah tries to shoot it apart. So Salvor puts an arrow through her throat, and then Harry Seldon emerges from the vault, which
pretty jaunty.
Kind of saves the scene for me. I won't excuse order. The old switcheroo that happens one too many times here, but yeah, Harry stepping out of that vault excites me.
I think they're counting on space psychosis to like smooth some of the gaps, but like I didn't think Farrah acted significantly more psychotic than she is baseline. No. Like her murdering the two pilots, that's just kind of what she does.
Yep.
Her, you know, ignoring her men's legitimate like concern over the nihilism of her plan is very on brand. Her wanting Salvor Hardin to shut the fuck up is very much been a part. Like, there wasn't like it, like her just turning the guns onto the vault, I think, is that also. But like, I felt like, I don't know, I needed a little bit more crazy from her and her lieutenant.
I was watching that and just thinking that's so Farrah. I don't see why. Yeah. Other than some physical manifestation, I think they would have had a hard time telling me that she is significantly mentally disturbed.
So I haven't read these books in, like I said, 30 years, but I recall that this is a plot. They know they talked about this in the main podcast, which I haven't listened to yet, of course. But like last week, they're talking about like this whole Invictus plot is from the books. It's a part of the books. Mm-hmm. And my recollection is when this happens, Salvor Hardin is like, you know, firmly the governor of Terminus, and Terminus is well established, and Salvor is very savvy, and he's very you know, with it, and he's got a plan, and more importantly, he's got the Anacreons, these barbarian kingdoms, kind of bent over a barrel because they want the warship, but they have no ability to operate the ship. So they start off the situation where it feels like the Terminus people are being kind of like put into prison labor, you know, compelled to. But then they realize that, like, who's really in control of the ship? The people barking the orders or the people that are the only ones that can actually control it?
Yeah.
And from that position, they force the barter and they force the cooperation, they're compelled. And I think this, you described it as weakness. I felt like this is the strain of the merging of that plot from a much more mature, confident, a dynamic Salvor, overlaying that plot onto this more embryonic, naive version of Salvor.
Mm-hmm.
Because it feels like her big, you know, appeal to Farrah and the Anacreons feels like a complete ass pull.
Whoa.
Put aside your literal millennia of bad blood and your skepticism of us Imperial citizens and everything. What if we just worked together and like shared this bitch? You know, it's like it felt desperate. And like what's wild is I felt like when I was, you know, a couple episodes ago, I thought like they had this plot firmly in hand that like all of the technicians were that the Anacreons were relying on to hijack the ship were in the places and they couldn't run it without them and that they were going to force that bargain. But they one by one killed all those people and set this situation up. So, I think it's weakness because you have. Fair, like it's a desperate Salvor rather than a confident Salvor springing a trap. It's like she's like, please, please listen to my crazy plan.
I agree with you. It is a crazy plan. I don't think it ever had a chance of working. Just saying, hey, we should all work together is foolish in that moment. It's naive. And I do think they'll round Salvor out into someone who's more competent, someone who's, better able to persuade people eventually of going along with her crazy plan, someone who doesn't love her and trust her unconditionally. So I think they'll get there. I think this is her. This never had a chance of working. And her saying it, I think, is showing that immaturity. Right. It's not just like. The show trying to say, hey, baby, this has a shot of working. I think the show knows it doesn't have a shot of working. Am I wrong about that?
I don't know, because it's also showing her maturing into her father's philosophy of that she's not going to result to violence.
And then she does. Even she has to.
But then she's forced to do it. So
which
like,
also shows even, the immaturity, the inability to, you know, be master of her.
Well,
master of her domain has some connotations,
So and so she has to be literally saved by the god from the machine,
but
we've talked about this in other shows, even great shows like Breaking Bad. Like, you know, there's a couple points where like I almost stopped watching in season two because of some crazy ass, you know, coincidence ass pull plot from the Gilligan. Like this. And I always call it as like, you have to get off the interstate because it's under construction and it's not quite fully baked. You got to drive over gravel road to get back on. And if the rest of the interstate's great, then I don't ever mind, you know, getting bogged in the back roads. And I think, like I said, I got a lot of faith in this production. I think that's what'll happen. But we just saw like it's a great idea to show Salvor as a more inexperienced, unsure person because she's a much more of an audience surrogate, you know. Can explain things and talk out loud and be, you know, it works really well. But when you pull this other plot from a later point in the story where they're not that person, it kind of the gears grind. They don't quite mesh. It's not fatal because, like I said, as soon as the Empire springs a trap on the Dawn plot, I'm like, oh, thank God. And as soon as Harry shows up, I'm like, whoo.
Oh, well, that's the thing, right? You know, like Harry could have stepped out of that vault at any moment and shut this shit down. It's almost an unforced error if there is an error here, because I don't think they should have had Farrah come back. I think she should have probably just died.
Yeah.
Before, like,
because they'd you could have had Space Psychosis second in command guy, not fully in charge of his capabilities, like trying to like and like, you know, we've already spent several episodes bringing him closer to Salvor's point of view. I think it would have worked a lot better putting him in the. Like impossible decision of like, are we giving up our plan? Are we going to trust these people or whatever? But
you lose some of the ability to like show how naive Salvor still is. But I think it would have made this seem less like, haha, I got you. No, haha, I got you. No, haha, I got you. This back and forth, like flipping the tables numerous times in this scene, just didn't feel right to me.
And there's also still a lot of questions like. Now that I've seen this play out, why the fuck the null field? Like, why would you do a null field that could potentially kill everybody in the colony unless they have the ability to ignore it? Like, what was the plan supposed to be?
Right.
And if it, like, was relying on Gale, when was that another audible? Because Harry said that he didn't know that Gale had the precog powers. And
but
also,
she did understand the Prime Radiant, and he knew that, right?
It's true. But like, unless she had the power to resist a null field, she would have ended up no better than Salvor's mother,
which she might. You know? We never got to see it.
So it's like, yeah, like what? Yeah, I'm feels like there's going to be a lot of explaining and heavy lifting in the next episode to kind of smooth some of this stuff out. But the other question I had is, so like, you know, how is this supposed to work? And did the vault, like, why did the vault dig into the ground, split open, send a big energy spike into the sky to just summon a hologram of Harry right. Seldon? Like, even if it's his full AI, like, the ship didn't fucking do that. And she put the
it's Harry Seldon so, clearing like, his throat. Do I have your attention?
or like, you know what they said in Rick and Morty? He's like, you know, Morty got to extend this ramp real slow. It makes these guys' dicks hot. Like, right. is he just like putting on is this literally Wizard of Oz shit?
It's theater,
like, you know. Yeah. It could be. But I do think that they need to answer like some of those questions. Like, what the fuck was the plan for this first crisis? How was the vault supposed to work? And et cetera, et cetera. And I hope it gives us answers, because like, I feel like those questions maybe can't wait till next season. But I guess, you know, I still got a whole hour of television ahead of me.
And you've got a speech from Harry coming. I mean, he doesn't just walk out, say, hey, how's it going, guys? And then anything going on I should know about? Like,
this looks fucked, bros. I'll see you in another 100 years. Hope you do better.
No. I think he's probably going to deliver some pertinent information to Terminus. We'll see.
Yeah, and they got a big, badass warship battle cruiser. I wonder what the Empire is going to make of that. Like, you know, is this more powerful than the Empire's whole entire fleet? Like, I don't believe that.
No.
So, like, what is the value of this ship? And I guess my thought is it's probably going to let these scientists and engineers study and reverse engineer a lot of this technology.
Could be
so that they're not reliant on the Empire anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think that will probably nicely kick off, because there's other pieces, like, you know, Hugo being the traitor, kind of like there's a lot of pieces here I can see that them picking it together and resuming the main storyline. But I do think they need to clear up some confusion and lay out more of like what Hardy, because that's the thing in the books is like, every time you got through a crisis or something, I came away more impressed by like Harry's plan and the subtle mac and the trust he had and the foundation and the process and how just kind of clever it all felt.
Sure.
And I still haven't felt the cleverness.
No, it's all felt very messy.
The promise of it.
It's all felt very like seat of your pants.
Yeah. Ad hoc.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Pulling rabbits out of hats. And
definitely going a different direction with that in the show. And maybe it'll all come back around here. Maybe this is the moment where Harry has planned for all this. We get the reveals, because Harry's been doing that, revealing, this was actually part of my plan. And, you know, you've played right into it. Maybe we'll have another one of those situations.
Yeah. And more of an active part of the plan as well.
Mm-hmm. So that's it, man. He steps out of the vault, and for all of the reasons we talked about in this scene, I cannot wait for next week's episode.
It works so great because Jared Harris plays this with this infuriating, like, cheerfulness.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, this is better than I expected. I had no idea you'd all be like, it's, you know, and it's great because I felt like that's exactly what you needed from him coming out of that hologram.
I will say in the book that Harry, it comes out of this gate. It's exactly the same in that regard. Harry is what's in the vault. But he is not interactive like we've seen Harry on the ship with Gale. He's just delivering a message. That's really all he's there to do.
Yeah.
I wonder if they're going to stick with that, or since they've introduced the concept of an interactive Harry, if he's going to be more back and forth conversation and giving advice that's relevant to the things that have happened.
And is the Harry that's in the vault the same thing that is Harry in his ship around Helicon? Right. Because it could be we're drawing conclusions about the Harry in the vault that is not valid for the, you know, the Harry in the ship was a direct memory consciousness. Maybe this is just more of a message in the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to see how they handle that next episode.
Me too.
Well, that's it for us. We actually have a little bit more. Jim and I want to talk a little bit book stuff after we get done exiting this episode. But if you'd like to give us feedback based on what you've heard so far, Foundation at Bald Move is how you get it to us. We'll have that episode out Tuesday. So you got that until like, you know, Monday morning or so to get us feedback for inclusion in the episode. Gotten a lot of great feedback so far, and I'm curious to see what you guys think of this episode, because I do think this is going to be what you would call one of them their divisive episodes. Not that there's been like a truly unifying there's a civil war amongst the fans, it feels like. The ones that are just like, hey, we dig this, and the ones that are like, this isn't exactly like the book. And we'll see how the community splits out. But I think this might be a little divisive. On the other hand, like, Harry popping out of the foundation has got to make you feel good if you're a book fan that, like, they're not just completely going off the script. Mm-hmm. So anyway, foundationofbaldmove.com. We'll see you in a couple of days. And now let's talk about the book stuff. Gail's voiceover.
Yeah, I think this is significant.
You think there's a lot of significance in this? Break it down for me.
When she says this is my history, and I'm telling it the way I'm going to tell it, so she gets to add the commentary, all that stuff. That to me says, like we speculated very early on, I think maybe the first or second episode, or first or second week, that these voiceovers might be the reading from the Encyclopedia Galactica that you have in the book. Which is like a retrospective thing, right? It's like you're reading from a finished work that you know the Foundation succeeded in creating. And so that, in my mind, kind of says that she is going to start the second Foundation and she is going to see this project through.
That's interesting, because I thought you're going... I don't know if you've seen any of these theories that Gail could be the mule.
I have seen those,
The outliers that threatens to wreck the Foundation, which I've kind of, I was favoring that myself. But then last episode or last feedback episode, the person has sent in the sleeper theory. Like, you know, I think it, that fits more into like your interpretation of this thing.
Yeah, where maybe she goes back to Synax after the wave, 137 years, and sets up that second foundation and succeeds in creating the Encyclopedia Galactica, which is essentially what she's reading from here.
Yeah.
It just uses a framework of the book a little more directly.
So my recollection of this character, the Mule, is they are a person who can manipulate people's emotions. Which I think they're changing into full blown like telepathy or this intuition. Or maybe not. Maybe they're just introducing a second phenomena. The other like chief distinguishing thing about the Mule, other than he's funny looking, is that he's sterile, which is why he got the nickname the Mule. He's some kind of hybrid creation that can't. So like he's a limited threat because he can do a lot of influence, but he's never going to be like a new species of human, you know. I wonder, because like I. When we're talking about mule theories, like everyone's looking at the fact that Gail has got this psychoactive thing, and then you can kind of squint and see that being a mule. And she seems like she's really pissed at Harry, and she's got an axe to grind. And so she's got like arch nemesis kind of written all over her. But the sterile aspect, if they establish that the Kleons are all sterile, which I know Goyer has said that that's how he views them. I don't know that that's actually been in the show yet. And now that they got this thing where they've introduced technology that nanobots can alter empire at a molecular level and like, you know, change their genetic structure. I wonder if like the Mule is going to be one of the empire, one of the like, you know, descendants like that, that has the nano stuff has gone wrong because of some jump drive thing or whatever. They've set up a curiosity in some of these like day, like being curious about what happens. Like, what if the empire just commanded, I want to be awake for this jump, and what would that do to his genetic code? And those are my two big candidates. You got the Gale as Mule, and perhaps the Emperor as the Mule. But
I mean,
also those are like big. If this is an 8-season episode, if you'd asked me, I'd be like, maybe they start laying the ground for the Mule in season 6. But holy shit, like right. Both of these theories posit way sooner than that.
Way sooner. Let me throw a wrinkle in here. We've already seen that Gail is fertile, right? They pulled a zygote from her.
And would the leading theory would be proof of that, yeah.
And I'm assuming Look, that's assuming if you want to use that to rule out the mule, it's assuming that they want to directly do a one-to-one here with the abilities and inabilities of the mule, right? It's not necessary that they keep the mule infertile. So,
no, it's not. And then some people might say, well, how do you know there's going to be a concept of the mule to begin with? Like, it's a kind of blink if you miss it. But in the very opening of this show, when Gail is referring to all the different historical figures that we're going to be talking about, she name checks the mule. It's like one of her first pieces of dialogue. So it's gonna show up sooner or later.
Mm-hmm. Got anything
else?
That's
all I got.
Spoilery.
No, okay. I just wanted to, because that's the thing I was curious about, how the voiceover tied in, and you tied it up there real nice. So again, we'll be back in a couple days to consider your feedback. Early next week, foundation@baldmove.com is how you get that to us. Thank you for listening. Thanks for liking and sharing and spreading the word about the show. Keeps getting bigger and bigger each week. We appreciate that. Couldn't do it without your support. Mm-hmm. Can't wait to talk to you about the next episode. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.